The following is a production of BYU Broadcasting in cooperation with the Brigham Young University Division of Continuing Education.
If you're a movie buff, you probably recognize this music. No? It comes from the 1994 film Il Postino, a scenic story about a friendship between an Italian postman and the legendary poet Pablo Neruda. A Chilean by birth, Neruda became a citizen of the world through his many travels, sometimes traveling by his own volition, other times as a political exile. Anything but a provincial man, Neruda collected enough life experience to fill volumes. "Poetry is an act of peace," he said. "Peace goes into the making of a poet as flour goes into the making of bread." Love, war, nature, family, society, and homeland are just a few of the threads that make up the tapestry of his work. I'm Marcus Smith, thinking aloud today with Ted Lyon, a faculty member in the Spanish department at BYU. We'll be discussing his association with and love for the artistry of Pablo Neruda. Ted Lyon teaches literature in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese, where he has also served as department chair. That's on the BYU campus. In 1989, he was recognized with the BYU Carl G. Mazur Distinguished Faculty Lectureship. He's also taught at the University of Oklahoma, the University of Wisconsin, Glasgow University in Scotland. He's published numerous articles and books on writers from the United States and the Caribbean. Lyon was a Fulbright scholar in Chile in 1966. And just a little heads up here for you, in that year, while he was there in Chile, he met Neruda firsthand, got to know him, and was a guest in his home. Ted Lyon has directed international study abroad programs to the Dominican Republic, to Mexico, Guatemala, and Spain. He's also served in Chile as a mission president for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Ted Lyon, it's a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
You know, as I've gotten ready to have this discussion with you, it's occurred to me, doing a little boning up, a little bit of reading here and there on this great poet. He is sometimes characterized as one of the greats. I've seen comparisons to Shakespeare. I've heard him called the greatest poet of the 20th century in any language. Before we even react to that, do you see any value or utility in these kinds of comparisons or rankings of some of our great writers?
Hard to compare across that many languages to call him the best poet in the world. I'd rather we stick with Spanish and say certainly in the 20th century in Latin America, he is the outstanding figure, no question about it.
And globally, is he not better known in other countries, non-Spanish-speaking countries, than here in the United States?
During his lifetime, he had over 2 million books published in 30 different languages. I mean, two million volumes published in somewhat 30 languages, but not as well known here in the United States, you're right.
Now, we're going to sort of break the chronology here and jump to your visit. Let's go right to 1966. Tell us all about that.
Well, in that year, I was in Chile doing research for my dissertation. On one occasion, I went to a poetry reading. It was commemorating the 30 years since the death of a Spanish poet. And Neruda read a poem there that he had written for the occasion, and so did Waldo Rojas. I was a friend of Waldo Rojas. And after the reading, I went up and introduced myself to Neruda, and Rojas was right by the side of me, the other young poet. We chatted a little bit. I congratulated him. It was just a formality. But then my young poet's friend said, Professor Lyon would like to come visit you sometime. Could we do that? And Neruda very willingly said, sure. Please come out to my house. We didn't set a time. But we knew that he lived out on the seacoast town of Isla Negra. You might think it was a beautiful, picturesque little village. It wasn't. It was a rather dirty little town at that time. It's since grown up to be a little more picturesque. We went out there, knocked on the door. Came in, I presented myself again because I don't think he remembered much of the detail of the previous visit. And we sat down and started talking, and one of his first questions was, why are you in Vietnam? This was 1966, and I wasn't prepared to answer, and so I simply made a little joke. Well, I said, I'm really here in Chile. I'm not in Vietnam. And he said, no, but you know what I'm talking about. And he was indeed talking about the first phases of the Vietnamese War. And he, as a writer from the far left, was upset at the United States for us being in Vietnam. Things calmed down after that, and we began chatting. And we stayed for about an hour and a half. Matilde brought us some tea, and we had a long discussion on Chilean wine, and I couldn't participate, darn it. I thought that, how can I miss this wonderful cultural thing? And that was the occasion. We chatted mainly about literature, about other poets, and especially that went back on García Lorca, the Spanish poet, whose 30-year death that was being celebrated or commemorated at that time.
You know, oftentimes we have these stereotypical notions of what a poet is like in his demeanor or comportment, and sometimes you think of them. There's this old romanticized notion of somebody who is so eccentric that they are sort of kept away. They keep themselves away in isolation. I understand that he was very much a social creature.
Pablo Neruda accepted people in Isla Negra, as evidenced by the fact that he would let me visit him. But he was often downtown in the flea market in Santiago, and indeed had a good rapport with people. His later poetry was destined or was written so that the masses could understand it. His early poetry, no, but his later poetry was very much that poetry for the masses.
Well, wasn't some of his early poetry, though, enormously successful?
It was. You bet. You're absolutely right. When he was as young as 18, he submitted his first book. It was published when he was just 19, and then a book published when he was 20 called 20 Love Poems and a Desperate Song. Did indeed sell a million volumes early on when he was very young. But I don't think the people, I better be careful of this because I don't want to offend anyone, but I don't think everyone understood those poems very well because they were pretty deep and pretty anguished poetry.
So inaccessible because of the difficulty of the language?
I wouldn't say inaccessible, but simply not as deeply felt as much as his later poetry when he got a little more simplistic. He was tending away from a movement called modernism, not our other 20th century modernism, but a modern modernismo in Spanish, which was flowery and so on. And he went into deep feeling and deep of how love was not fulfilling, love didn't satisfy. And most of the people did read them as real love poetry, but they were almost anti-love in the sense that love is not fulfilling. Love doesn't make me feel as I would expect it to feel.
You know, we've got to sample some of his art. And so I understand you have some translations of your own making. I do want to get to back to the chronology of his life, but let's hear some of his work then. And why have you brought what you've brought to represent him?
Well, one of his early poems from this earlier period is a pretty anguished bit of poetry. He was in a surrealistic phase that he'd picked up from Europe in his travels around the world. And the title of the poem is called Walking Around. Let me just read a little bit of it because it gives you the difficulty. It so happens that I'm tired of being a man. It so happens, going into tailor shops and movies, I am withered, impervious, like a felt swan, navigating a water of beginnings and ashes. A whiff from a barber shop does it. I yell bloody murder. All I ask is a little vacation from things, from boulders and woolen clothing, from gardens, institutional projects and merchandise, eyeglasses, elevators. I'd rather not look at them. That's just a little short line from the poem. I'm walking around and seeing all these things, but I don't fit in. I can't think. I'm tired of being a human being, being a man.
Now, that's an excerpt from the
That's a much, much, much longer poem. I'm not going to take time to read it. But if you'll give me a chance, I would like to read another. This is a little bit longer. In the 1950s, after Neruda had espoused communism and an attempt to lift up the masses, he started writing books of odes. And instead of an ode to liberty or an ode to beauty or an ode to highfalutin things, he wrote an ode to an onion, an ode to an avocado, ode to my socks. A lady had given him a new pair of hand-knit wool socks, and he wrote an ode to that, taking the very common thing, and he used a very common language as well.
Well, before we hear the poem, I mean, on the face of things, that seems almost like adolescent kinds of silliness.
I guess it is, unless you look at the artistry of the poem, maybe the title or the subject matter.
Which I've unfortunately just preempted, so go ahead.
Well, this is one that I just translated when we were in Chile this last time for my wife. In Spanish, the title is Ode to Oda a la Jardinera. In English, I translated Ode to a Woman Gardening. And I think you'll see that the way he describes it and the metaphors he makes are pretty... are above the high school youth type of poetry. And it's obviously written to Matilda, the woman that his wife is of his last years. It begins, "Yes, I always knew that your hands were flowering stalks, silver lilies. It was your way with the soil, with the blossoming earth. But when I saw you digging, removing the little rocks and caressing the roots, I instantly knew, my dear flower gardener, that not only were your hands, but your heart as well was made of earth, that you were there shaping what you love, creating moist pathways through which seeds would sprout. So, passing from one freshly rooted plant to another, your face stained by a kiss from the fresh loam, you came in flourishing, shining, went out again from your hands, and from your hands the alstomeria sprig raised its solitary elegance. Jasmine sweetened the mist on your forehead with stars of sweet scent and dew. The whole of you prospered, piercing the earth, instantly becoming a green light, foliage and power. You communicated your seeds with the earth, my beloved flushed gardener. Your hands spoke to the soil in intimate language, and bold growth was immediate. Further, my love, your moist hands, your heart of earth, lent fertility and power to my songs. You touch my chest and I sleep, and trees spring forth from my dreams. I awaken, open my eyes, within me you have planted a maze of stars that rise with my song. And so it is, dear gardener, our love is terrestrial. Your mouth is a plant filled with light, a corolla. My heart labors below in its roots." Hope that's not too long, but anyway.
No, I think we need a poem like that to really get into some of his poetry, his ideas, what he is celebrating. That does not sound like the resignation or the anguish of an unfulfilled love that you mentioned earlier.
That's correct. Here, and he's now in his 50s, and he's found a great fulfillment in life and love. And these poems are poems of praise and not poems of anguish at all that we find in earlier poetry.
So he does go through a season here in later life, mm-hmm. where would you characterize him as being optimistic about life's experiences?
Generally optimistic. During the first, his younger years, he's anguished, he's distressed by war, by violence, by the political situation of his own country and of the world. But as he ages and matures, he seems to harmonize very well. He knows that there's trouble going on, he knows that there are problems. But his poetry is reflecting a much more calm state, a much more, I'm in touch with the earth, I'm in touch with people around me, I'm in touch with life, and it's positive.
Do you suppose that there might be a case made for this, that early on in life he produces this anguished poetry, then he has tremendous success with his publication and circulation, and then suddenly he's in the public eye, and that alters to some extent the themes that he approaches?
I think there's more. It's not just it's not just a response to the public. It's his own experiences in life. But his early poetry is often anguishing as an individual, as me, that I simply don't fit in. I'm in soledad, which means aloneness, very, very isolated. Maybe isolation would be a better one. But an event happened in 1936 and 37. He was in Spain when the Civil War broke out. And he wrote a poem at that time called "Let Me Explain a Few Things." Explico algunas cosas. And in this poem he said, "I've been lost in myself. Now it's time to talk about the world. Now it's time for me to extend myself to the suffering souls who are really suffering. My anguish has been individual, but I see masses who are now suffering. I have to talk to them." And from then on, he started writing books called, three of them, Residence on Earth, and which meant that I am now going to talk about the people who live on this earth. And he begins a phase looking at political things. He goes to Machu Picchu and writes about how the people, the greatness of the people that lived in Machu Picchu. And all of these things result in the fact that his own political life, he tends toward communism. And I don't want to give any idea that he's a rabid communism trying to overthrow the world or America.
But very involved in the idea that the people...
Social justice for the masses.
Mm-hmm. We'll get back in just a moment to sort of some key times, milestones in his life. I want to talk about the nature of the language. We've heard it in translation. How would you talk about the sounds of his poetry in their original form? Because those sounds, whether they're mellifluous or harmonious, or if they have cacophony, all of those things are very important to the success of a poet. How do you describe the sound?
I have to admit that that part of his success came because of the sound of his own voice. Neruda, when he read his poetry, had a very monotonous sound, and I'm going to repeat the rhythm. And he read his poetry just like this, and it sounds so exaggerated. But truly, that's the way not the way he spoke, but the way he talked when he read his poetry. And the world loved it. He read in New York Poetry Center, and the majority of people didn't understand the Spanish that he was reading.
Was it a hypnotic cadence?
But it was a hypnotic cadence, just like you heard, yes. Huh. And you felt that thing. So more than the sound was the rhythm of the poetry.
Was it dramatic, or would he understate the drama of the poetry?
Very much understated. He didn't get into the anguish or anything of that nature. No, it was just that melodic, rhythmic thing that brought you into the poetry.
And was that just an idiosyncrasy?
It was an idiosyncrasy of his. Nobody else that I've known in Chile has ever read poetry quite that same way.
And if someone were to try to do it, they'd probably be scorned for imitating.
For imitating Pablo Neruda, yeah, exactly.
Now, in terms of the forms of his poetry, was form of importance to him? Rhyme, meter, elements of prosody?
Of course, and especially in the early stages, he was following some Spanish traditions to begin with 11-syllable, 12-syllable lines that aren't going to be too important for us right now. But he did follow that. But toward about halfway through his life, he recognized that content was more important than form, and he preferred to deal with that in anything that he did. His odes, for example, may be lines of just one or two words on a line, and he's no longer concerned with the structure, the rather rigid structures of Spanish poetry.
I'm Marcus Smith. This is Thinking Aloud. I'm visiting today with Ted Lyon of the Department of Spanish and Portuguese at BYU. We're talking about the Chilean poet Pablo Neruda. Now, Neruda was not his name.
Thank you. Yeah, he was born in a small town in slightly southern Chile. We're born Ricardo Eleazar Neftali Reyes y Baso Alto. It's a long name. Everyone in Chile has two last names, mother and father's names. But he changed that name largely because his father, who was a railroad worker, and he certainly didn't come from a cultured family, although his mother did try to push that culture. His father objected to the fact that he was writing poetry, and his father even destroyed some of his early poems that he was writing when he was 8 and 9. The family moved to a place called Temuco, a town called Temuco, a beautiful town in southern Chile. His father working on the railroad. And there he adopted the name of a Czech poet, Jean Neruda, and just accepted Pablo, and from then on became known as that. I think it was 1942 or 43. He actually took that as an official name. It was legally changed.
So was this an attempt to have a pseudonym so he could write under cloak of anonymity?
Yes, that's right. So he could write without his father knowing that he was writing poetry.
Father more than the public.
That's right, yeah. He wasn't trying to hide himself from the public. He was trying to hide himself right at first from the father. But then it became a thing that he just carried on, and you had to do it, and you became that identity. That is, he became the identity of his pseudonym.
But it switched from Jan Neruda to Pablo at some point.
Yeah, and I'm not sure why he chose Pablo Neruda. He must have liked Pablo for something. Mm-hmm. I could probably trace it back and find some uncle or somebody that was meaningful to him and encouraged him to write poetry.
How would you characterize his assessment of the role of the poet in society?
That too changed. Early on, it was to express individual concerns, individual language. Later, he got into the idea of a poet has to create pure poetry that lifts the people. And so he really wanted to get to the people. But he had an incredible, simply natural poetic flair. Let me just mention an anecdote. In 1990, I was in a little town called Quincha Mali in southern Chile. BYU was helping a little town to preserve some of the native art, the folk art that the women were doing, making black pottery. And the Kennedy Center had had paid some money to help this keep going. And I went to a little guest book, a registration book. There's this little shop that they had. It was just a little family shop, and they'd built a little workshop out behind the house. And I was just thumbing through this little registration book. I'd already written my little thing that said, "Beautiful art, thank you very much." And I came across a little inscription that was just intrigued me, and I wrote it down, and it said, "A mí también me hicieron de greda, pero no con tanta gracia," which translated means something like, "I too was created from clay." These people were working with black earth. "I too was created from clay, but not with such grace." And I thought, my gosh, just to register in a little registration book where you're supposed to write down your name, here he writes to me a poem. "I too was made of clay, was created from clay, but not with such grace." And so he was even relating to the masses in that sense. I mean, he was writing in a book, writing his poetry in a little registration book. In a fun way. It was kind of a fun experience, thinking, wow, some people are a long ways above me in creating a poetic world.
Well, this is interesting because there are caricatures of poets in and it goes back to the notion of the romantic poet, where the poet is kind of stuck in that vein of always having to wax eloquent.
Mm-hmm.
When you met him, he was just a normal guy?
Oh, yeah. He wasn't an attempt to be any poet, to make a second identity as a poet. He was Pablo Neruda, the Chilean lover of food and wine. Neruda looked kind of like Buddha in the time we visit him. Very, very
portly.
Portly. He loved to eat, and especially seafood. Big fan. And Chile has a long enough coast that they have plenty of seafood, and Chilean wine and other things. So easy to get along with, to relate to him as a human being.
Now, he was known as somebody who was a collector. He would physical objects. He would do, and different categories of interesting things. A lot of them connected with the sea, the ocean. He had these figureheads from ships built
That's
into
right.
his home. How do you assess that he was a collector of things, and how did that inform his poetry?
Neruda has three houses in Chile. One of them actually inherited from one of his wives. One in Viña del Mar, and I guess it's in Valparaiso, right on the coast, looking up on the hill, looking down the Isla Negra house, where I visited him, and another one in Santiago called La Chacona. And all of these are filled with things. First of all, books, obviously. That's the thing he collected. And he really did collect thousands and thousands of books, and the houses are still filled with them. A collection of bottles, collection of mastheads or figureheads in the houses, collection of seashells and other things. I recall him saying at that time, as we were commenting on his house, he said, "I'm in love with things. Things have an entity. Things have a unity of their own, an entidad única, I guess a unique entity." And
Maybe even just the tangible aspect of things. I go back to that poem that you recited, where the earthness, the terrestrial aspect of the gardener wife, mm-hmm. is tangible and real.
Yeah, very good. That's absolutely correct. And I think that's part of the reason of collecting. Is to say, I can touch it, I can feel it, I can hold it, and that inspires me, just the feel of it. He has a whole series of poems on the rocks of Chile and the rocks that he can hold in his hands and touch, and that somehow something was springing from the rocks that was creating a sense of poetry in him.
Poetry is often used in the service of political agendas, and I'm wondering if his poetry served a cause, or if the cause and his social and political activism somehow served his poetry. What was paramount for him there?
Neruda does indeed have a period, this time of residence on Earth, when he's very much involved in poetry. He has a poem, for example, again, the title is in La United Fruit Company, United Fruit Company, where he says, when the trumpet sounded and all was in readiness on the face of the earth, Jehovah divided his universe, Anaconda, Ford Motors, Coca-Cola, and similar entities, and the United Fruit Company Incorporated reserved for itself the heartland and coasts of my country, the delectable wasteland of America. So very political in that sense, against the big U.S. company, the U.S. companies that were, he felt, dominating Latin America.
Would he ever have thought that there was some diminution of the value of poetry if it then was subordinated to a social or political agenda?
I think you're right. I think he matured a little bit and left that later on and found more simple things to praise and view poetry as praising rather than criticizing, rather than critical.
The waning years of his life, he had been a political exile. He had many government posts. He'd been in diplomatic posts and also as a representative of the people, as a senator. In his waning years, did his social activism decrease?
Oh, by no means. Quite to the contrary. He was ambassador to Paris in 1971 when he received the Nobel Prize. But in 1973, May of 1973, just 4 months before the coup took place, he published a big poster that says, "Watch out, the revolution is coming, this should not happen." So he continued right up to the end of his life, very, very active in the political
scene. And if there were those voices who wanted to ban him at some time, has it come to the point today where nobody would even dare attempt that in Chile?
He's too big. No one's going to ban anything that he's written.
And so, on the contrary, any political faction might want to appropriate him as their own?
You bet. You bet. And they have. Even during the dictatorship, he was used and cited. Not a lot, but he was still... They didn't dare destroy him.
Well, Ted Lyon, I'm very appreciative of the time you've taken to visit with us today about the poet Pablo Neruda. Thanks for coming to Thinking Aloud.
And thank you for allowing me to speak on this wonderful poet.
It's a pleasure to have you. Ted Lyon of the Spanish Department at BYU. We've been talking about Pablo Neruda, and you can learn more about our program, Thinking Aloud, at our website, classical89.org. Along with other information about our show, including past shows and podcasts, we welcome any of your comments at our email address, thinkingaloud@byu.edu. Views expressed in this program are not necessarily those of either Brigham Young University or of its sponsoring institution, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Our production team consists of Wes Sims and Koyo Iyamba and BYU students Marco Villarreal and Robin Miners. We hope you listen for us every weekday at 11 o'clock Mountain Time. Remember that on Tuesdays we bring you a BYU devotional or forum broadcast. Thinking Aloud originates in the studios of BYU Broadcasting. We're right here in the heart of the Harris Fine Arts Center on the BYU campus. I'm Marcus Smith, and this has been Thinking Aloud.
Thinking Aloud is a production of BYU Broadcasting, made possible in cooperation with the Brigham Young University Division of Continuing Education.